First of all, I was born in Liverpool, England, April 3rd, 1909. All my family has been military-minded. Father, grandfather, etc. All seen service.
Which regiments were they in?
My father was in the 1st King's Liverpool Regiment. And his father was also in the 1st King's Liverpool Regiment. So that goes back quite a while.
Yeah.
All my family, with the exception of my daughter, had seen service in the regiment. I was married the second time after I came back from Hong Kong. My first wife died. Married the second time, and my second wife was in the Navy. Her daughter was in the Navy, and her son was in the Air Force. So all in all, we got quite a little history through the family, both families, my stepson and stepdaughter.
When did you come to Canada?
And 17th of April, 1926.
And how did you come?
I migrated as an immigrant.
On the boat? Did you come in?
Yes.
On the boat, and do you remember the name of the boat?
SS Montcalm.
And where did you land in Canada?
Landed in Quebec.
And you took a train to?
No. No, I didn't. I went to the immigration authorities in Quebec. They sent me to a farm and place in Kinburn.
Yeah, that's good.
And worked at on a farm just 60 miles southwest of Ottawa, a place called Kinburn. Well, I was treated exceptionally good there. In fact, if I'd had my way, them days and had any opportunity at all, I think I would have stayed to farming rather than anything else. But I found it very interesting and took more interest in farm work than anything else. Although I never did do any farming myself other than during the Depression years. Came to winter, I went to Kapuskasing in the bush, worked in the bush for approximately 7.5 months, cutting wood and going through the drive, as they call the drive, this is sending logs down the river. And I took a freight train and went to the coast, and the coast I traveled back again. This is during the Hungry 30s now, when you didn't have any money at all. Landed in Winnipeg approximately early 1929. And I've been here ever since, which is more or less my home.
Did you have military experience before?
Yes, I was in the Winnipeg Light Infantry, 1932.
And which rank did you attain?
I went up to a sergeant major, which they call a WO2 those days. I took various courses while I was serving in the Winnipeg Light Infantry. Advanced signaling course, instructor's course in the signaling. Those days there was no things as radar, it was just heliograph, semaphore, which is flags, and Morse code, which is your tapping system, the same as they used on the railroads. Then took small arms, revolver, bayonet fighting, rifle, Vickers machine gun, well, practically every course that was available. Took advantage of every opportunity to do whatever I could to improve myself in the Reserve Army.
When did you join the Grenadiers?
My outfit, the WLI, was called on guard duty before war was declared. We were called out on active duty on August 28, 1939. And we were guarding bridges in Winnipeg, like the Bergen's Cutoff, which is in Codonum and various other places. We had sentries posted there on guard duty just in case of sabotage. Then eventually, they decided to disband the WLI, turn them into a veterans guard. which wasn't up to my standard of soldiering. So I reduced from the rank of sergeant major to an ordinary private and transferred over to the Winnipeg Grenadiers. I was taken on the strength of Private Windsor in the morning in the part one orders. Part two orders came out in the afternoon and I was made a full corporal. So from there I had to carry on and work myself up to the best of my ability.
What training was done in Winnipeg before you left for Jamaica?
Well, not too much of the training, because there was very little facilities for the training in Winnipeg. They trained at Mental Armies at the start, which is your Vickers and 303 Lee Enfield, bayonet fighting, etc., unarmed combat. And when the Prince of Patricius went overseas and we took over 4,000 barracks, we had a little more chance for night maneuvers there, but still not, in my respect, the training that we should have required to be a soldier in combat.
When did you leave for Jamaica, and how, if it was train or boat?
We left by train in the spring of 40, I forget the exact month. Went by boat from Halifax.
Which boat was this?
This now is something that I just can't remember the name of it, to be honest with you. I forget the name of the boat, and that's Sunwinger. But I do forget the name of the boat. But we landed in Jamaica then, and there we were stationed on garrison duty, which was more or less guarding prisoners of war that had been picked up by the British, mostly, and Canadians, shipwrecks, torpedoes. We even had a trip to Curacao and Aruba to pick up prisoners of war there and bring them back to Jamaica, where we interned. And then there was a various bunch of individuals went over as instructors to the Bermuda, Bahama, to instruct personnel there and whatever they could. We had not too much training in Jamaica on account of the conditions there and the equipment that we had. But we did have night maneuvers, and basically it was all military guard duty. No, hardly any at all of basic training with weapons.
What was the life like in Jamaica?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, in Jamaica it was the finest 18 months I'd ever put in. There was sunshine night and day. And also at the same time, there's what we called upstairs, a place called Newcastle. There were three miles as the crow flies, but 19 miles by road, which you kept on going up and up and up and up. The most remarkable thing there is standing on the parade ground in this place called Newcastle. And you'd have your winter clothing on, and it'd be raining, it'd be cold, and you'd be in the clouds. And every once in a while, the clouds would break, and through those clouds, you could see the people downstairs playing cricket and soccer right 110 above. It was very marvelous.
How long did you stay in Jamaica, and can you tell me something about returning to Winnipeg?
We were in Jamaica approximately 18 months, and we returned to Winnipeg. All those living in Winnipeg were asked to stay in Winnipeg, like to stay in the Robertson building. Those that lived outside of Winnipeg were given leave, furlough, to go home. We weren't too long here. fact, most of us didn't get any of our leave that lived in Winnipeg. So we were told that we were going to be on the move again. And with the equipment that they gave us, most of us got the impression it was another garrison duty. And we all felt, the majority anyway, felt that it was going to be a place like Singapore, because we had the tropical suits again, etc. But it was kept very secret. We didn't know where we were going or what we were going to do.
When did you leave Winnipeg?
If I'm not mistaken, it was September
1941. And how did you leave? By train?
By train. And we went to Vancouver, where we caught the boat, which was the Ottawa Tier. This is one of the things that was a terrible affair, because the conditions on the boat weren't up to normal. There was tables underneath and the personnel was sleeping on hammocks above. And I had served in the merchant service before I came out to this country, so I could understand the men's feelings when they wanted to revolt against the idea of having to sleep in hammocks above and people eating underneath, the seasickness, etc. The first place that we stopped at on our way to Hong Kong was Honolulu, where everybody was told to keep below deck and show no identification at all, because we didn't want to let anybody know where we were going or who we were, like, in other words, Canadians. We landed in Hong Kong, the Japanese already had pamphlets out greeting us. So it was quite a surprise to us.
Was any announcement made at all on the boat of where you were going?
No.
And was there anything that happened on the way that you can remember?
No, the only thing that I can remember is approximately to build up strength, to bring us up to battalion strength. We took on 350 recruits scattered from all over Canada, various places in Canada, of which most of them were youngsters and had no training whatsoever. In fact, quite a few of them could not unload a rifle or load it. It took us 21 days to get to Hong Kong, and it was hard for the likes of anybody with any experience at all to try and teach the necessary fundamentals of army life to youngsters like this. That was, from what we gathered and what they told us, it was a matter of you and you report to the grenadiers, and that was all there was to it. This is something that was very, very hard to understand as far as I'm concerned. I feel that while we were in Jamaica, the 2nd Battalion was built up to strength, and they were supposed to be the reserve battalion. And any reinforcements that we should have had to replace those personnel should have been taken from the 2nd Battalion of the Grenadiers, who were fully trained. But we didn't get anybody at all from them. And this, as I felt, was one of the sins of the war. This is my personal opinion. What other people have said, I don't know, but this is my personal opinion.
Your arrival in Hong Kong, what was this like?
The arrival in Hong Kong was just something similar as any other port. It was just a natural thing to march up to the barracks and take over your quarters.
What was the camp
like? We went to Camp Shifu. Basically, tropical huts, the same as something similar to Jamaica. The X number of personnel in a hut with a sergeant on each side. platoons. Well, we used to call them sections. I went up on an exchange program to in physical instruction and exchange with one of the English sergeants. By that time I had been made a sergeant in Jamaica, so I was a sergeant when I landed in Hong Kong. And we exchanged PT programs with each other. In other words, I was helping instruct English on the Canadian PT and the English were instructing the Canadians on PT. We called the place where we went to, where I went to anyway, it was Peak Mansions, which is basically the my quarters for the English regiments that were there, the Middlesex and Royal Scots. By that time, most of the personnel from the English regiments had been shipped to various parts of the continent, most of them to Australia, I understood, as the married wives, the kids, etc.
What training was done in Hong Kong after the arrival there?
Well, there was really no training at all. We hadn't any equipment to train with.
Where was this equipment?
This equipment was following us on an export, we were told.
Did it ever arrive?
No. Never did arrive. And not only that, the equipment that we did have was out of date. The 303A rifles that we had were no value to us because they hadn't been sighted. And when war did break out, that you set your sights at 100 yards, you don't know whether they were going to hit something at 500 yards or 600 yards or 50 yards. This is one of the things that hurt as far as the fighting regiment was concerned. Many people have said that we weren't fully trained. Now, I agree to a point that we weren't fully trained, but there was enough manhood in the regiment and esprit de corps with what equipment that we did have that we, if it had been of any value at all to us, that we could have put up a better showing. The mortars, for example, they did have, maybe one would go off every, fired in every six or seven rounds, the others would be duds. In other words, the equipment was out of date and it was no fault of the personnel themselves.
Battle now. Where were you when the Japanese planes started to attack, and what were your reactions to it?
Well, this is one of the peculiar things you're hearing. Little noises way up in the sky, and all of a sudden you hear boom, 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 and they started to break the airstrip first, which made no difference anyway because there was only a couple of planes there, and the planes that were there of no value. I mean, to get them off the ground, I don't think they would have been able to do that even. They're more or less training planes. And before you knew it, we were stationed on the perimeter of Hong Kong and were told that the Japs had broken through the front lines, which is the Royal Scots and Middlesex, who were defending the mainland at on the outskirts of Kowloon, and they were coming across the water behind mules, in ferry boats, anything that they could capitulate, they were swarming onto the island. We were up in the pillboxes, various descriptions. This is something else that they could fire a 303 bullet at. The pillbox was supposed to be concrete. At 100 yards, the bullet would go right straight through the pillbox. So, a beautiful pillbox that we had. With the result, we never sat in any pillboxes. We were taking whatever cover we could and taking advantage of the terrain that we were in. But we had no chance at all, let's be honest, although we were outnumbered, we didn't have the equipment. That was the basic part of it. I still feel personally with the personnel that we had in the Grenadiers, a great bunch of guys, and the morale was of a high caliber, and we would have had a better fight if we'd have had the equipment. But under these circumstances, when the order came to capitulate, that's exactly what we did, because we had nothing to fight with.
Where did these orders come from?
The orders we received came from a runner. Now it's with Captain Norris Taylors. He used to have a tailor shop, and one of the finest officers ever got still on 2 feet. And with Major Hook, we were told to pile our arms in a certain place, wait there. With myself and a few more fellows, we did whatever we could to smash the bolts and of the rifles and the Victus guns that we had. We took them out, muzzle caps and attachments, and scattered them all over, buried them, did whatever we could so that they were going to be useless to the Japanese. We didn't get much time to do anything anyway before they were there.
What happened when the Japanese did appear?
They seemed friendly enough in a sense, although they were rough in their abuse. We could not understand what they were trying to tell us, but we were pushed from pillar to post like a bunch of little fleas. We found out, much to our amazement, that we didn't do as you were told. It was just too bad. It was discipline of its highest caliber. However, this is their method of being soldiers, as they call it, in warfare. Well, therefore, you can't hold any grudge against them for the treatment that we were getting. We were their enemies, and that was all there was to it. Although all the time that we were in the prison camp, both in Hong Kong and Dormin, where I was, I still say that the Canadians were treated better than any other nationality. They did show some respect for the Canadians.
Where did they take you after
you were captured? Well, we went to Shamshapu first, and then we went across to Hong Kong itself. Where there shortly, we had to build a enlarged airfield that was there. It didn't make any difference whether you're warrant officer, sergeant, NCO, or buck private. It didn't make any difference at all. You just had to work, and that was all there was to it. We used to go across on the ferry every day and enlarge this airstrip. Then approximately a year later, they decided those that were fit enough would be sent to various parts of Japan. The one incident that stands out in my mind was the attempt of four of our boys to escape. I don't think I should mention names because it would hurt personnel, but the plan was well set. Nobody knew anything about it, not to my knowledge. I was not aware of what was going to take place, but it was well thought out, well planned, and kept well secret. And next thing you know, we had notified that the four of them had been captured and mistreated very badly, and that's the last we heard of those. The true story of what happened, this is something I don't think we'll ever know. Some people think they know. I've heard rumors, but myself personally, I don't know. I wouldn't commit myself to, because I am not sure what did take place.
What type of food were you getting this time?
Well, when we first started, it wasn't too bad. It was more or less half our rations. Then it started to deteriorate to rice. I remember one time they brought a small pig in. I was supposed to do the whole works. Needless to say, we didn't see too much of that. But my personal opinion is that we weren't treated too badly for the first couple of months, because it was the Navy who had been trained by the British that were in charge of us. But after that, it was heartbreaking to see the English regiments, such as the Royal Scots and the Middlesex, who had been there for X number of years and had married Chinese girls, and they would allow the Chinese girls to come up to the fence and talk to the husbands, and the next thing you know, they beat them and kick them away. It was very heartbreaking for them. To us, we used to get beatings periodically over anything at all, any excuse at all. One individual that stands out in my mind is gave us the impression of what we were in for, where we did watch our P's and Q's from then on, was a man they called the Kamloops Kid. I never did find out his Japanese name, but we called him the Kamloops Kid, and he addressed us to the extent that he'd been born and raised in Canada, and when he went to school he was called this, that and the other by the Canadians. Now it was his turn, and it was his turn. Every opportunity he got, he took advantage of it. And in fact, there was one particular instance where this Captain Norris, I was standing right alongside of him, and he came up to Captain Norris and knocked his glasses to the ground, with the result that Captain Norris, most automatic thing in the world, looked to see where his glasses was, and I gave him the excuse to bring his knee up and butt him, and then beat him right in front of everybody. This, I think, was something that broke the hearts of quite a few of the individuals. It's an utter disgrace to see any officer being smashed about, more especially so Captain Norris, who, as I say, was a wonderful man, a wonderful officer.
What draft were you on to Japan, the first or second?
I was on the first draft.
And how many men were there, and what was the trip like?
Well, this is hard to estimate the number of personnel, because we were shipped like sheep in a fold. We're all down in a hole, just like you'd put cargo. And they would pass pails down, and would have to urinate and everything else in that. Then they would bring it up, but it did no good whatsoever, because there was quite a few of the boys still had dysentery. And with us being packed in a hole like rats, it affected them to such an extent they didn't last too long when they did land in Japan proper. One of the main items was the effect that we're told not to take anything with us, because there'd be lots of everything for us in Japan, such as food and that. Conditions where we were, where other boys were, I don't know, but the camp that we were in, the conditions were 10 times worse than they were in Hong Kong, because all we received was rice, nothing but rice. The first few months wasn't too bad. It seemed to fill up on it, but a half an hour afterwards you were absolutely starving. When you did get any greens at all, it was tops of anything they could get a hold of. In fact, we had a bunch of Americans come in from Tom March. They were badly swollen with beriberi. One of them conceived the idea that there were lots of snakes around, and they went out, those that were unfit to go down in the mines, went out hunting snakes. And they built two pits, one they kept the snakes in and one they kept the frogs in. And they treat the frogs to the snakes every so often. And this American skinned them just the same as you take the finger off a glove. And first of all, they tried to boil them, which was no taste to it at all. But when they fried them, we got a bit of grease out of it and a little more taste. But then, with our stomachs now shrinking, our bowels shrinking, and the grease has created havoc with quite a few of the personnel, that we started to get dysentery all over again. But the least thing, the least excuse that you did, it gave them an opportunity to beat you up. And of course, the Japanese method is they go from rank to rank. You could be my brother. We join up together in the services, and your name is on first. You sign before I do, then you're senior to me, and then you beat me up. Well, this carries on down the line to the lowest Japanese in the camp. Now, he's only got one thing, one person to bring up, and that is the prisoners. He can't take it out on any of his own back personnel because they're all higher than him. The comical part, I think, kept us alive more than anything else, especially in our camp. We used to laugh ourselves silly with it. But they were forbidden knives, forks, spoons, pencils, pens, etc. One day they would make a tour of inspection unexpectedly and come across a fork. You're hoisted out into the compound where you were dressed, kept out there for 4 or 5 hours while they searched, and they found knives, spoons, everything, but they never touched anything because they were looking for the fork. And about 2 weeks later, somebody used to think, well, boy, oh boy, we were foolish. Last week we were looking for a fork and we found a knife, so they'd go and start looking for knives and they'd find forks and something else. I think this itself, the humor itself, kept us going. And we used to take beatings over because we couldn't stop from laughing, and they would slap us. Although they couldn't hurt us for the simple reason that they used to use the palm of the hand to slap. And the best idea we found out was to take about 5 or 6 of these and then just lay down on the ground and moan, and they'd leave you alone. They figured they'd hurt you. Although we did have some of the boys badly punished. They would do this in method of putting lots of salt in the rice, putting them in confinement and making them stand. You couldn't lay, you couldn't sit, and this was one of the basic punishments. I served 5 days, and I know it was enough for me. I didn't think I'd ever live to tell the story. Down in the mine, they varied. You had people that were in charge there that were rough and tumble, but at the same time, you could put up a little argument with them and try to save men from going in various places where you figured it was unsafe. I took a couple of beatings on occasions by arguing with them, but it wasn't my point of argument because I told them it would cave in, and before you could say anything, it did cave in, so we saved quite a few of the boys, although we had some very bad cave-ins. There was one case in particular, a man by the name of Roger Novus, who was caught by a rock fall, and it was a solid piece, a huge piece. I'd say it weighed 4 or 5 ton, without any exaggeration. He was caught right underneath this. It was pure luck. There was a cavity in there to an extent that his arm was the only part that was pinned. There was roughly about 15 men lifted that. I don't think any 60 or 80 men could lift. But I was boiling mad at the time that he was caught on it, and I said, we've got to get this man out some way, and you're not pulling enough weight, and boiling up mad at me, which I wanted to, and they lifted this piece and we pulled the young Novus out, and I think he broke his arm through it. I think he still suffers. I haven't seen or heard him for a couple of years, but I know that he must suffer the tortures of hell with it, because it was madly mangled when we were in there. Well, there was humorous sides of the story. As I say, most humorous is when they would search for something, and of course we'd have our own things to look forward to.
Which camp did you go to first in Japan?
I was Omina. I was there all the time. I never switched camp from the time we landed in Japan.
And whereabouts? Is this situated near Tokyo?
Is it north? No, it's south. It's in the next island to Okinawa. I think it's Kyoshi, if I'm not mistaken.
Was the men that were in this camp worked in the coal mines, did they?
Yes, we were all in the coal mine.
How long were you in this camp? From the time you got there till the end of the war?
Till the end of the war.
How long a period was this? About 3 years?
Roughly 3 years. Not quite.
What was the sickness like in the camp, and what type of medicine was available?
We had no medicine at all. Let's face it, they didn't have it themselves, so we couldn't get it. We had an American major there by the name of Smith, a medical officer. He did what he could for us, but at the same time, there was nothing there for us.
What sicknesses were those? Dysentery and beriberi?
Dysentery and beriberi. One thing we didn't have while we were in Japan and Omina was something that we did have prevalent in Hong Kong, which is diphtheria. We didn't have one case. And we didn't have very many deaths in the camp that I was in. The men seemed to show a lot of cheerfulness. Although there was such a thing as warrant officers and sergeants, the likes of this, they mingled in together. It was just a bunch of men trying to survive and get along with each other. In other words, I was never called sergeant, just sergeant major. I was called Red, and I just the boys and the proper names.
What was the food like? Was it still rice?
Still rice.
Basically. Anything extra added at all?
Well, they used to bring in something that they was in a powder form. They used to call it curry, but it was no curry at all. There was no taste to it. They opened a canteen and gave us 10 yen a day for so many days. This is of no value at all, because you couldn't buy anything anyway.
What did the men do for recreation?
There was nothing you could do for recreation, because you were too tired. By the time you put 16 or 18 hours in a coal mine, you weren't fit for any recreation. You were just dead tired.
Were there any days off given to the men?
Very, very seldom. Very, very seldom. Like, the most time we had off was when we were told shortly the war was over, apparently, what we didn't know about it. They told us the big cave-in at the mine there'd be no work. This went in for 4 or 5 days, and I had the funny feeling that we did have no more work, that the war was over. A couple of us took a chance, and then we had a Union Jack in the camp, which we smuggled with us from Hong Kong, and we put this up just to see what would happen. They never said nothing about it, and this is when we found out that all the people that were looking after us had vanished, and there was only the sergeant left, which was, we call the soldier. And this is when we discovered that the war was over. And when I came back from Hong Kong and went to a veterans organization, I was on the executive at Fort Getty Legion, and they still have that Union Jack there. I presented that Union Jack to them, the one that we hoisted on.
Who was it that they made the reaction on near the end of the war, when the Americans did start flying planes over and then eventually dropping supplies?
This is something really funny. It was when they first started to drop more, we were putting everything we could out to attract the attention of the planes. We didn't know where to go or what to do. There was some individuals took off on their own. We got these supplies dropped all over the place. And this was a good idea, but I think they should have been dropped more on the basis of a diet than K rations, as we call it, and all that, bully meat and chocolate bars. I think this is one of the things that we're paying the penalty for now. I do think when we came back from overseas to regard us as our personal feelings towards our families, etc., that we should have been segregated and sent to a convalescent camp for a period of time to gradually get back onto our food instead of just being discharged and thrown to the dogs. This is something that I feel myself was wrong, and I think this is why we are paying the penalty right now for such a thing.
When the Americans started dropping food, what was the first things that they did drop? Was there medical supplies, or was it
food
itself?
No, it was food itself. That's all that they were concerned with. Food, and then to get us out there as quickly as they possibly could.
How long did it take before they did have at least probably?
Oh, I would say there was 7 or 8 days after they started to drop the food that the last personnel were out.
And where did you go from the camp? And how were you taken? Where were
you
went to?
We went to, I can't think of the name of the place now. I think it was Nagasaki. And put on the plane, which was P-47 and B-29s, where they'd taken out the bomb racks and put in 2x4s or any 4x6s, anything at all to get us out of Japan. The first place that we landed there was Okinawa, where we were grounded for 3 days on account of the hurricane. That was something very unusual, where they took 4-ton lorries, fastened into the wings of these B-29s and P-47s. And we were in the huts for 3 days while this hurricane was on. When the hurricane was over, there was the planes laying on the back and the 4-ton lorry sitting on top just like little pieces of paper. That's a hurricane. I don't want to see any more. It was really good.
Where did you go from here? Did you fly all the way from Japan to San Francisco?
No. We went from Okinawa to Manila, where we were interrogated. Approximately there 3 days, then we went across the bridge. This is another thing I've always tried to remember, to this small military base just on the other side of Frisco. And we're there for X period of time, and then from there we were given American uniforms, because all the Canadian uniforms had been given to the English. So the Americans gave us their uniforms, and we took a train from there to Seattle. I had quite an experience in my bunch that I was with. We had Louis Armstrong and his orchestra traveling on the same team with us. They had about five coaches, and needless to say, they entertained us. They took us in there and wined and dined us and entertained us with his orchestra and assigned a menu that was there. I must have that menu somewhere around the house. It's something I value. And we landed at Seattle and went to Victoria. It was then that I learned that my wife was seriously ill and been in the hospital for 3.5 years while I was in a prison camp. They tried every method to get me back as quickly as possible by plane, but priority had ceased. And as a stewardess, which I'm not going to mention names, I seen her personally afterwards. She found out my situation and they were turning me down for a ticket. And she told me to hang around a little while, which I did. I was just about ready to give up the ghost. And a couple of hours later, she says, "You come with me and don't say nothing." And she put me on this plane and she said, "Now you sit there and don't move." And next thing you know, before we plane took off, there was a man raising Cain because he'd booked his flight and everything else. And this girl had seen fit to change, told him he'd made a mistake. It must have been a mistake because the plane was full and every passenger was accounted for. And this is how I got back to Winnipeg. I was met by Scotty Harper, who's dead now, but he met me at the Winnipeg airport, and we went down by taxi to Winnipeg General Hospital. See my wife, who was dying.
So when do you get shot at that?
Went home. My sister-in-law was looking after my four kids. And being stubborn variety, I thought that there was something could be done for my wife other than what was taking place in Winnipeg, so I took her down to the Mayo Clinic. We were down there approximately 9 days.
How many yards can you walk?
And that was it. There was nothing could be done. They cost a little fortune down there. And that is something else that hurts when you want to get your wife back home and you have to pay the bill. I had to wire out to her for the money to cover the bill before they let me out of the Mayo Clinic with the hospital. But needless to say, I buried my wife 11 days after I came back from Hong Kong, and a few days later buried her mother. They were both in the same hospital right alongside of each other, and none of them knew it. My mother-in-law didn't know that her daughter was in one room, and my wife didn't know that her mother was in the other room. It was a tough thing to have to come back to. It was one of the toughest things I ever had to face in my life. To live for a wife and four kids and then come back, and all you got left is four kids. So this is the ambition I had now, is just to see what I could do to bring up the kids, because my wife, the last words my wife says is, "Thank God you're back, this is all I've been waiting for. Now I can die in peace." So she did. It's one of those things that you can't avoid. One of the peculiar incidents that happened, as I say, the humor in camp. This particular place that I was in Almena, they would bury the dead. We had a bugle that could sound the last pulse in the valley. We would do it. There was one occasion that I did it, not to a great extent, because I was a bugle and deck boy before I came out to this country in the merchant service. with a humorous incident. We had an English fellow coming up from the mine, and one of the cars, which they call hack horse, the chain broke loose and this car caught him, buried his leg, his left leg, in the wall of the mine, with the result that it was badly mashed up, and to make a long story short, they amputated, and they built a box just the same as for an ordinary human being, and had full ceremonial honors, and buried the leg just the same as you'd bury a human being. It was part of a human being as far as they were concerned, so they had the full military honors for it. Took him up and buried him alongside of the other personnel that had died in the prison camp. Then we had 6 or 7, I'm not quite sure the exact figure, individuals. One of them had been in quite an accident a couple of years previous to us landing in Hong Kong, one of the English boys with the English regiment. He'd been split over the head and had a silver plate in his head. And when the news came through in our camp of a release, we were all free. Everybody was hunting here, there, and everywhere for whatever kind of food they could get. Even a big bar of steel didn't make any difference what kind of food, as long as it was some kind of food, nothing different than rice. And these boys were given a portion to drink. They thought it was alcoholic. It was alcoholic, all right, but in the Canadian terms, we call it gasoline. In the English term, it's petrol. And they drank this. And as I say, I forget the exact figure, but there were 6 or 7 of them. With the result that they died, and they died in a ball. The feet and the head came together just like a ball. And they had to break the bones and reset them. And they dug a mass grave, buried them right in the camp where we were. Just set fire to them, little wooden boxes for caskets. This is something I never forget. The last portion to drop into the grave was this silver plate from this fellow's head. And we were forced to stand there to watch that everything was buried. But the other part that I was telling you about was a couple of months after the war, when we were taken prisoner. They took quite a few of us out. We had to pick up bodies here, there, and everywhere. And this is why quite a few of our boys that were killed that we were able to identify with the dog tags. And this is why we knew that ex-personnel had been killed here and everywhere in action. And they just piled them on top of each other with Japanese, English, whatever, Chinese, whatever the were in the field, were dead, threw petrol over them, burnt them. After everything was all burned, there was nothing but ashes, and these Buddhists who had been brought up from Japan put certain portions of the ashes into jars, and they went back to Japan, and they, from that day to this, the personnel were known as that was a certain Japanese that had been killed in action. Kind of a comical thing, but I guess they were doing it. But this is one of the worst shots we ever had, was the stench of the dead after being so long in the fields.
Did they bury the bodies, or did they cremate them?
Cremate them. That's when we were taken prisoner. But after they started to die, because quite a few boys started to die of dysentery and diphtheria, they were buried just the same as we buried them.
Now, was the funeral service in the camp, or?
No, just outside.
Just outside?
Yes.
When did you get your discharge?
I didn't get discharged until 46, because I tried very hard to stay in the services. Felt that I finished my time in the service, and I wasn't too long to serve, because my overseas service would mean double time, plus the service I'd seen in the militia before the war. And I practically only have about 6 years to go, I would have been able to retire on a pension. I passed all physical tests, but when it came to the knees, that was a different proposition. I had serious injuries in the mines on the legs, and so it all showed up on the x-rays with the result that I couldn't stay in the permanent force. But I did serve for nearly a year in the what they call out a call-up to help fill vacancies created by permanent personnel being discharged. I even traveled with a what we call a caravan displaying armed goods, ammunition, etc., the equipment that they had at various fairs throughout Manitoba. Wherever these fairs went, we followed them. And we would put up a display there and have a kind of a tattoo, a military tattoo of a night time, and it was quite interesting.
So you got your discharge in 1946.
Right.
And where did you go from there?
I took a physiology and anatomy course at Portage La Prairie and worked in Deer Lodge here for 2.5 years in physiotherapy. It was a remedial physical training instructor. He cut the staff here, and I think one of the reasons was that I was one of the first to let go, although I had proved my capability was the Hong Kong veteran, where we started to deteriorate by this time. And I had taken my work too seriously, working on patients, even coming back at a night time. To do work on patients here as anybody here. These old timers will tell you that's why they all know me here. And from there I couldn't give up the thought of just being an ordinary individual. I took a position as athletic supervisor in town of Souris. And I was there for 3 years, and that was the three best years of my life as far as I was concerned, as instructing and every mode of sports, but non-gymnastic displays, taking the youngsters in hockey and baseball, badminton, tennis, swimming, boxing, wrestling. Also relieving the teachers in the school there from grade 6 up for a period of an hour a day, and teaching the youngsters first aid and physical instruction, giving them PT. This is one of the things that hurt me in a sense, because I've never been an individual to show or to give on theory or follows demonstrate. And I did the work myself, and I started to lose a lot of weight and go back down again to such an extent that I was forced to give this up. That's when I came back to Winnipeg. I took a short period of rest, and then I joined the tea company.
In what capacity?
Something I'd never done in my life, painting and decorating. I just happened to meet an old buddy of mine that I'd played soccer with years before the war, and he was manager, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him that I just come back from Souris and I was going to look for a job. This is on a Thursday, and he says, "You start for me on Monday painting and decorating." So I didn't ask any questions, and that's how I come to start with the tea company.
And where are you now?
Still with the tea company. I'm in charge of maintenance now for the whole of the mail order. That covers MOB 1, 2, and 3.